Hello, I'm Oliver Wong.
And I'm Morgan Rose, and you're listening to Heat Rocks. Last week, we debuted our new special series, Take Two, where we take two albums from an artist's catalog and discuss each on back-to-back weeks. Right now, our focus is on Janet Jackson.
Last time, we broke down Janet's breakout 1986 album, Control. And today, we wind it back to 1997 and her sixth studio album, The Velvet Rope. As I just mentioned, Velvet Rope was Janet's sixth studio album, and much like the other autobiographical elements on her previous LPs, this latest offered some sneaks into Janet at both mid-career and also just gracing her 30s. The album that came out before that, 1993's Janet, was supposed to be her I'm Grown and Sexy LP, but while she certainly brought some of the sexy on that album, Velvet Rope is where we got the groan. We learn later that her life was much more complex than most of us ever knew, with Janet being in the middle of a secret, almost 10-year marriage to dancer Rene Elizondo Jr., who ends up co-writing much of this album. And though most of her personal revelations were made more obliquely than explicit, The Velvet Rope gave us some insights into Planet Janet being the exploration of her sexuality on the album's BDSM and bisexual themes, addressing the cost of the AIDS crisis, or tackling domestic violence. Musically, we also hear how her, Jimmy Jam, and Terry Lewis had matured as well. They were still masters of the dance form, but Velvet Rope wasn't trying to still sound like it was 1988. House and hip-hop were heavily in the mix when Janet wasn't in full red light slow jam mode. Listening back now, it feels clear that her and her team knew where pop music was in 97 and opted to insinuate their own signature style within it without sounding like they were pandering. This Janet, it seemed, was hella chill, and I was hella fascinated. When we talked about focusing on Janet, I think Control was a no-brainer, but I also feel like both of us thought simultaneously, without having to discuss it with one another, that the second album had to be The Velvet Rope. How is it that we both landed on The Velvet Rope? Why does it stand out to you as the other album to talk about in this Take Two segment?
To me, it represents another big change in Janet, whereas Control took her from bubblegum pop star to like Janet the Icon, or the beginning of Janet the Icon. I think Velvet Rope also marked a shift. When you mention Got Till It's Gone, to me, it almost felt very neo soul Janet, the way it was shot. It sounded like it could have been a song.
Oh, totally.
You know, it gave me very Soulquarians vibe. And that was a change for Janet, the samples and all that. And also too, whenever I mention Velvet Rope, I get that response like,
right.
You know what I'm saying? So it's always like someone has a feeling like this was edgy or controversial, Janet. And that's why I thought we should bring it up for those reasons. Right. I really wanted to explore that other Janet.
Right. And I think to that point, in both the name of the album, right, we think about velvet as a fabric. What does it feel like? What does it evoke? In what context do we see or hear or feel velvet? I guess we don't hear velvet, but whatever. You get my point.
I hear velvet.
The imagery that we know, that we see on the album, in the videos, but also just the album art itself. This was a very sensual album, very sensual Janet Jackson. And compared to the more, as we discussed in the last episode, the more very innocent, even if she was in Control, still very young Janet, as I was saying earlier, this was grown woman Janet, and one that was just brought this level of sensuality, which is why I think when people go, oh yeah, The Velvet Rope, I imagine, at least for me, that's partly what they're reacting to, is that that's the sensuousness of the album itself.
Right. Exactly. And Velvet Rope also means exclusivity. So you have to go, you know, you have to cross a velvet rope to get you know, personal access. And I think that's sort of symbolic here, that she's given you a little bit more access to her story. Then there was a little bit, there was guardedness around Janet before. And Velvet Rope gives us a lot to start with, not just her look, not just the cover art of the album. It's like, okay, Janet, where are we going? And I think what Janet's saying is we're going behind the velvet rope.
And so along those lines, where was Janet Jackson at by the mid-late 90s? And as we talked about in our previous episode, Control made her a star. Rhythm Nation only intensified that stature. So where was Janet by 1997?
Well, she's certainly a $100 million artist at that point. Because in a couple of years before, she's had signed a huge contract extension with Virgin Records. Like huge, massive. Right? I mean, gigantic. She's in her 30s, her early 30s. And as I'm in my 30s now, I'm just playing. I just wanted to say that. She's going through all those epiphanies that you have in your 30s. And also, too, she's made a name for her. This is post-Poetic Justice. So she's already gotten the Golden Globe. The film's gotten the Golden Globe and the Oscar. She's super A-list at this point. Super A-list. And I'm sure courting a lot more attention from the press than she had on previous albums, because now she's built up something. We've got Janet, we got Poetic Justice, we got Design of a Decade, major keys. And then there's a 4-year absence between the last album and this one. And when Janet shows up, we know that she's been through some things. We know that she's said on MTV that she's been dealing with depression and that she's been revisiting some memories or some things from her childhood. And she's more open than she was in the early to mid 90s.
Right. I alluded to early in the intro about how some of the songs, or at least one of them, deals with domestic violence. And I think it's not a big secret that this is partly in reference to what she grew up seeing in her own household. Mm-hmm. Something you just said made me think about how Velvet Rope comes out after a 4-year hiatus, which in pop years might as well be a lifetime. And especially in the 90s, you think about how dramatically pop music and especially black music and R&B and hip hop changed from 93 to 97. The fact that the Velvet Rope could land in 97 and sound completely on time at neo-soul, as you were alluding to before, there are parts of this that do sound very neo-soul-y. And it's not like neo-soul has been around for a ton of time. I mean, D'Angelo's album's been out for a couple of years, but Badooism, I think, also comes out in 97.
Yep.
So it's not like there's a lot of examples out there. And yet, Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis managed to make everything meld into what the sound of 97 was. And I think that's impressive as anything else, given the fact that she was out of the mix for 4 years leading up to this LP.
Right. It's so on brand with the times, and also not just in the neo-soul of it, but there's dance tracks on here. So dance music is totally, starting to, you know, you got dance music coming back to prominence, and dance music and soul starting that sort of early collision. So it's completely, you know, it's completely on point for the time. And Janet stays relevant. She stays relevant, and she was just as relevant on this album as she was in previous albums. So yes.
Where does the Velvet Rope land within her discography for you?
That's a good question. And I'm going to just speak as honestly as I can here. It's my second favorite after Control.
Even more than Rhythm Nation.
It is.
Wow.
It is.
Is it because it's got all these interludes, including a voicemail message? Because we all know that some of your favorite things. This album just delivers the Morgan Rhodes special right there.
That's it.
Interludes and voicemail messages. There you go.
And that's it. And because I'm self-absorbed, this album speaks directly to me for those reasons. And also, I like what you said earlier, that this is grown woman Janet And I like grown yeah. woman Janet. And I liked unguarded Janet. And I like Janet that, yeah. That let us in. There, you know, we've talked about Rhythm Nation. It's a great album. You know, it's a great album, but there's something about this. I love the production of it. If I didn't know this was Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, I don't think I would know that it was Jimmy Jam, Terry Lewis.
No, that's a great point. And I think it speaks to how relevant those two managed to stay in the mix to be able to make a hit album in 97, well over 10 years, you know, into their hit making career. And it doesn't have to sound like an obviously Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis sound. And yet what they nail on here is still, it's still wonderful in terms of just having that pop magic, right?
And it still bumps without, even though we've said that it's true to 97, it doesn't feel dated to me. So when, right. when you hear the sound of Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis on Controller, for that matter, Rhythm Nation, it takes you right back to that time. You know, that's unquestionably of the time. Velvet Rope can still get bumped today. And it doesn't necessarily be like, oh, that's 1997. So there is sort of a timelessness to that sound. And it is very surprising coming from Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis and how they sounded on Control. You asked me where Janet Jackson was at the time. And one of the things that she said, and one of the reasons I love this album is its transparency and her transparency. And one of the things that she said about this was that she was going through heavy depression. And she told Ebony at the time, quote, "I've been burying pain my whole life."
Mm.
And that's powerful when you think about all the secrecy surrounding the Jacksons and what was going on with the Jackson family. And that this was the album she chose to unburden herself. And that's what's so attractive about hearing grown woman Jackson, Janet Jackson, because she's also grown in her decision to navigate these really complex emotions and heavy emotions.
There's nothing more depressing than having everything and still feeling sad. You must learn to water your spiritual garden.
It must be difficult for any artist to decide how much of that they want to reveal through their music, because these are people who are under such, you know, nonstop scrutiny in terms of the paparazzi, the tabloids, especially when you're a Jackson, you know, family member, and that it's perfectly understandable why you might want to hold some of that back. So the fact that you get a little bit of a glimpse into her inner self and inner life is not a small thing, because these are people who, especially given her particular career, and again, like I said, her biography, it'd be totally understandable if she was very opaque about that. But the Velvet Rope is, to go back to the metaphor of it, she's letting us behind, right, into the VIP section of her life.
That's
to
right.
some extent, even though I'm sure we're not getting all that we could have gotten.
That's right. And for those that, you know, that take that for granted and don't see the significance of it, it was 1997. But in 1997, there was a price to be paid for being that open and that honest about where you are. She's talking about homophobia, and she's attacking that stuff, and there's a little bit right. of tongue-in-cheek stuff right. we can get to later.
Yeah.
Which was bold and risky for 1997, not so much today.
Well, we will be back with more of our Take Two conversation about Janet Jackson's The Velvet Rope after a word from some of our sibling Max Fun podcasts. Keep it locked.
I'm Riley Smurl.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
And I'm Taylor Smurl.
And together, we host a podcast called Still Buffering, where we answer questions like,
why should I not fall asleep first at a slumber party?
How do I be fleek? Is it okay to break up with someone using emojis?
And sometimes we talk about butts.
No, we don't. Nope.
Find out the answers to these important questions and many more on Still Buffering, a sister's guide to teens through the ages.
I am a teenager.
And I was too.
Butts, 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 butts.
No. Will you change your mind?
Hi, I'm James, host of Minority Corner, which is a
podcast that's all about intersectionality. It's hosted by James with a guest host every week.
Discussing all sorts of wonderful issues, nerdy and political.
Pop culture.
Black, queer, feminism.
Race, sexuality.
News.
You're going to learn your history, their self-empowerment, and it's told by what feels like your best friend.
Why should someone listen to Minority Corner?
Why not?
Oh my God, free stuff.
There's not free stuff.
The listeners of Minority Corner will enjoy some necessary LOLs, but mainly a look at what's happening in our world through a colorful lens.
People will get the perspective of marginalized communities.
I feel heard. I feel seen.
Like you said, you need to understand how to be more proactive in your community, and this is a great way to get started.
Join us every Friday on Max Fun or wherever you get your podcast.
Minority Corner.
Because together, we're the majority.
We're back on Heat Rocks with part two of our Take Two conversation about Janet Jackson and her 1997 album, The Velvet Rope.
Morgan, as you often say, confession is good for the soul.
Yes.
And I confess that I probably would never have really paid attention to this album if not for, I thought it was the lead single, but apparently it never came out as a commercial single, which is incredibly surprising, which is Got Till It's Gone. And up until this point in her career, I had never thought of Janet as being deep in conversation with any kind of contemporary hip hop in any part of her career. And we actually talked about this in the Control episode about how Janet never seemed like she needed or wanted to make a hip hop crossover song because that just wasn't what she was about. I'm not saying this is an example of that, but certainly Got Till It's Gone deeply feels like it is, it understands where hip hop is at in this moment and does it in a way that is true to Janet, but still for someone like me, who was a big hip hop fan in 97, this was a song that she could make that would speak to sort of my sonic sensibilities.
Sure.
And I think The Velvet Rope in general as an album, and we'll get deeper into this in just a moment with some of the specific songs, I think is the album that comes closest to that conversation with hip hop compared to anything else that came before.
I'm surprised to hear that it wasn't released as a single. I didn't really know that.
Yeah, it somehow managed to chart, but apparently it was never a commercially released single, which, and again, you know,
that's
for my own biases, as I stated, it's the one song off of here that I remember more than anything else. And the fact that it wasn't a commercial single, I'm like, oh, word? I guess I gravitated to it just because of the Q-Tip Connect and whatnot. So, I mean, maybe I got that wrong. We have some angry, like, discographic folks out there being like, of course it was a single. It charted in Chris Melanfi listing right now. It's going to be like texting me like, well, actually, you know. Shout out to Chris Melanfi.
Shout out to Chris Melanfi. That's a good dude. But you know we're going to hear from somebody that's going to be what you guys missed. Love you, Heat Rocks, but what you missed. But yeah,
right.
I just assumed that was the single.
Right. And what's funny is in thinking about what I find to be the fire track off this album, I went into that question assuming that the answer will be Got Till It's Gone because I bumped it so heavy back in 97. But while I certainly still dig that tune, I think I actually have to give the new nod to Together Again, which was a song that could have also been my sleeper jam. Because I totally, totally slept on Together Again back in 97. But now when I listen to it, I just love how it is so 1990s house music.
Oh, yes.
And it just taps into my nostalgia for that particular style and sound of that era. I have to imagine that this was remixed to death, and we actually took a quick break to look this up, and on the 12-inch version of the song, it does have some key house remakes. Tony Humphries is in the mix here. Jimmy Jam does his own remix, and unexpectedly, because I completely forgot about this, DJ Premier did a remix of this song. Shout out to Primo. I don't know if this is like his best remix work from the 90s, but it's cool that he got on. Like, it's nice to see him in the mix here.
Sure.
What's your fire track?
I'm going to stay with what I had here. I'm not going to change my mind. Way back when, I would have said Got Till It's Gone.
Yeah.
Because that's a gem even still, for all the reasons that we talked about. But in prep for the chat, I kept rebumping My Need. It reminds me a little bit of, I kept hearing Love Hangover, but maybe that's because it's sampled Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell, You're All I Need. But it's very disco and very sexy. That's my jam. If we can hear some of it. Little slow down disco, but dancey. And it's just sexy. I should have bumped that more, but I was so stuck on some of my jams, including We Go Deep, which is also, I could have gone there too, because We Go Deep is fire too.
Sure. Absolutely.
We Go Deep is fire, but I love My Need.
I think it's interesting that both of us started with Got Till It's Gone, but decided to go with a different song. And I wonder, I don't have deep thoughts about this. I'm sort of wondering why it is that we both ended up abandoning what would have been the kind of the obvious pick. Does that say more about us in the passage of time since in the 23 years since, or does it say more about how the song has aged, do you think?
I think it says more about us. I think we both gravitated to that song at first because of the aforementioned reasons, because of the production qualities. Yeah. But as you like to say, with the benefit of hindsight, there are other jams on this album that we may not have spent as much, time with. It doesn't seem, I don't want to say that Got Till It's Gone is the obvious choice, but for us, I'm not surprised that that's what we went with first.
Right.
But in listening back to it, that we both went with a little bit more up-tempo jams, a little bit different feel vibe-wise, that's interesting. And I guess I just didn't spend as much time on My Need, and I think in prep for the chat, I just kept going back. That's the one that I kept going back to on this album.
Right. I feel that. Let's just pretend that we have no more tomorrow. Can't we make love like it's our last time, baby? Let's not get too soft and gentle with it, 'cause I am not feeling. How about favorite moments? What jumps out to you off of The Velvet Robe?
Well, I know my mother's not listening to this because I didn't tell her about this episode. So I can say that my favorite moment is Interlude, the speakerphone.
Hello?
Hi, it's me.
You got me on that damn speakerphone.
Yeah, I do.
What you doing with your hands if you can't pick up the phone?
Don't you worry about it. I'm taking care of my business.
It was a surprise, and someone asked her about that, and she said she got a lot of questions after that, like, was she gay? And she was like, what difference does it make? My love for interludes.
Yeah.
And you know that interludes have to be connected to phone conversations. Yes. This is so perfect. And it's also, we've seen sensual and intimate and sexy Janet. We never see her, do that with a woman.
So in the Morgan Rhodes ranking of album interludes that involve the phone, we talking top 5, top 10, top 40? Where does this rank here?
Top 10, because I think I didn't, most of my interludes that I really love is because the conversation is on point, or because they're so funny, or because they're so real. Like a lot of my favorite interludes are connected to the Wu-Tang, right? If I'm honest.
Right.
Also to the Bad Boy era. Because Mary J. Blige, Faith Evans, Biggie all had great, those are all skits and interludes. This goes in my tops because it surprised me. Because I just wasn't expecting this from Janet. And so and that's that on that.
I feel that.
That's what I'm going to say
I
on
feel that.
Yeah.
I don't want to get in trouble with your mom.
Yeah.
She scares me.
And she's so sweet.
No, she doesn't. I mean, she doesn't scare me. She does seem very sweet. My favorite moment on here, and this speaks to what I was saying before about the ways in which this album is very conversant with hip hop, not just in 97, but really just the traditions of hip hop. It's the song Free Zone, which is very much, and just such a surprise to hear on it, because it's like a late 80s cut and paste edit, like Cold Cut or like Double D and Steinsky. Shout out to Steinsky. He's a good dude.
Yeah.
Right. The main difference is that it has an LGBTQ anti-homophobia message that you probably would not have heard in the late 80s, but nonetheless, otherwise sonically, it very much is in that vein of those classic cut and edit songs. And this, I mean, in particular, Free Zone is a walk down the park of different breakbeat classics, which includes drums from Lynn Collins' Think, I think some of the stabs from Pleasure's Joyous, and a little bit of vocals from Archie Bell and the Drells' classic Tighten Up. Mm-hmm. I was also going to say, even though it's not credited, that bass line sounds a lot like The Ghetto by Donny Hathaway.
Yeah, it does.
So you got a lot of, again, a lot of classics working their way through here. And Free Zone is a song that I had completely slept on the first time through. And now it just jumps out at me because of that collage of all of these different hip hop classics intermingling on here. And it's just a very, it's surprising and very delightful for that. So, but yeah, that moment where you first hear the Archie Bell sample of Make It Mellow, because you just, you're not expecting it. And the whole song is full of surprises, but that one, that's one of my favorite moments on the LP.
Well, hell, the whole album is full of surprise moments. And I love that I love that we both pick things that have LGBTQ themes and adjacent themes. And I do think there's that Janet was exploring the spectrum of sexuality on this album.
Which probably might seem a little bit pedestrian by 2020 standards, but in 97, this was still very much a really big deal, especially on the mainstream level.
Indeed.
In terms of sleeper jams, what's one of the songs that that has popped out to you in later years that maybe you weren't giving enough attention to when the album first dropped?
You. And I'm saying this, and I love this song, and I love this album, but I think a lot of people, and I love you, but I think people sleep on it. It's the song on here that, to me, reminds me the most of Rhythm Nation. It's got Rhythm Nation-esque qualities to the production, and I love all the different voices that Janet inhabits on this. Whispering Janet, angry Janet. I love the honesty of the song. And she also said, as she was interviewed about this song, that she should have named it Me, because it's about her and her struggles, but people kept accusing her of making the song about Michael. And it wasn't about Michael. It was about her.
I think my sleeper jam would be I Get Lonely, which I think has really, really aged well, even though I think the sound of it is very much of its moment, which is that, to me, it sounds like a late 90s R&B jam, but it's also just an exemplary example of the form itself. There's definitely a lot of these days throwback 90s parties that are out there, and especially 90s R&B parties. And this song absolutely belongs within the pantheon and heavy rotation of what those parties are meant to represent and capture. I still remember to the day. In fact, it was the third Monday you came along.
And I'm glad you mentioned I Get Lonely, because one of our former guests, B. Slade, has a beautiful cover of I Get Lonely. He covered it a lot in live performances.
No one but you. I get so lonely.
Wow.
Right. Right.
You know what's so interesting about that is this is something I was thinking about in our last episode, which I didn't mention because it was just kind of a passing thought. But Janet, as far as I know, she didn't come out of a church tradition, unlike other R&B stars. And so you don't really hear it in her voice. She doesn't do like the kind of gospel runs or any of that stuff. So it's really interesting to hear one of her songs being covered by someone who is very clearly conversant in that tradition of singing and bringing that is, you wouldn't hear that in Janet's own singing, but it's so fascinating to hear someone put that on one of her compositions.
Man. And he's done it a bunch of ways. He's done it gospely. He's done it jazzy. I mean, that kid's just gifted, but it was wonderful to hear him. He's obviously a Janet fan, as we know, because of the episode that he did with us, but it was wonderful to hear him. His cover of this is so beautiful.
So, Morgan, what song would you play for someone, speaking of playing songs, what song would you play for someone who had never heard The Velvet Rope and you wanted to introduce them to Janet Jackson circa 1997?
It would be a toss-up, actually. It would be between We Go Deep and Got Till It's Gone, because I would I would want to sort of, you know, underscore the point that Janet had changed, and that also... the production had changed with Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. That this is how relevant they were to the sound of now and how relevant Janet was to the changes. So I'd want to do that.
Right.
We Go Deep, I think, just sounds like a 90s R&B bop. And I love that song. So I think this is my commentary would be about what 1997 and black music sounded like, but also how Janet Jackson came from a 4-year hiatus and came out the gate swinging with an album that covered a bunch of styles, that was transparent and open and had bops and had house music and had samples and all these things and interpolations and all these things that we would have never associated with Janet before. So those two songs, We Go Deep and also Got Till It's Gone.
And before we wrap up our discussion about The Velvet Rope, I was wondering if we could just pull the scope back a little bit and kind of go meta Janet here for a moment, because one of the reviews I came across in prepping for today was from The Needle Drop, which is the very popular YouTube music review series that's done by Anthony Fantano. And in his review, and he actually just did this in January, so the timing was quite good, he talks about how Janet Jackson has gone surprisingly underregarded in the social media era. And it's a thought I had as well, especially when I reviewed her 2015 album, Unbreakable, is that Janet Jackson went from one of the biggest pop acts of the late 20th century, but has, I think, been largely rather invisible in the 21st. It is just weird to me that she seems so largely invisible of the last two decades, considering how big she was in the last two decades of the 20th century.
It is interesting that she's not mentioned, and disappointing, because unlike other pop stars, I'm not going to take anything away from Madonna and what she might have done. But I go back to my point again that Janet Jackson paved the way for so many other artists after her that has to contribute to her currency, and that has to contribute to her value as a pop star. Not only is she iconic, but that she created all these other artists who went on to be iconic. And just all the trinkets that I mentioned, some of those records no other artist has caught up with. This is in pop. This isn't in some other genre. This is strictly in pop. We hadn't seen an artist like Janet before Janet. And for that reason alone, she should be in that conversation. First ballot, Hall of Fame, Gold Jacket, no question. Okay, so if you had three words to describe Velvet Rope, and keep them spiritual, but if you had three words to describe Velvet Rope, what would they be?
It would be all groans up. And I just rewatched Swingers for the first time in a while. And so that iconic phrase from that movie just came to mind. But it also, as we've been talking about, this is an album where you are getting grown, not really quite middle-aged Janet, but certainly older Janet, and someone who giving us a different side of herself that we hadn't heard before. So for all those reasons, that's what the three words that came to mind. Mm-hmm. All grown up. Our baby's all grown up.
Real grown. And if you like The Velvet Rope, then these are the albums that you should check out. Oliver, you first.
Well, we actually talked about this artist in our last episode about Control, because this artist, was giving a shout out to Control. And that is Missy Elliott. And in particular, I would recommend folks check out Missy's debut album, Supa Dupa Fly. I think A Velvet Rope is the notable 1997 mid-career R&B album. Then Supa Dupa Fly was the year's outstanding R&B debut from 97, with Timbaland filling in the role that Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis had held down for the previous 10 years as being the new producer on the scene that you needed to work with if you wanted to just to be cutting edge. And I think between him and Missy, they were in a certain kind of way like the new Janet, Jimmy Jam, and Terry Lewis triumvirate, except now as a duo. Shout out to Magoo. I guess you want to throw a third person in the mix. Actually, no, Aaliyah. Aaliyah is the third person in that particular soup right there.
Indeed.
How about you?
I would say stay in 1997 and go to Mariah Carey and Butterfly. I wish someone would come on Heat Rocks and talk about Butterfly. But again, you have an artist stepping out of that bubblegum pop and very controlled image into her own, you know, getting involved with hip hop in a way that she hadn't been heretofore. And coming out of a very guarded persona around herself that I think might have been a studio construct and not her own, and stepping into her grown womanness and her sexuality, and I think Butterfly set her on the tone to being an icon, and she's a megastar, and also signed a big old huge contract with Virgin Records. So you got those two have a lot in common.
That will do it for our first Take Two experiment talking about Janet Jackson's Control. And of course, on today's episode, The Velvet Rope, we hope you all enjoyed it. Morgan, should we let folks in on some of the other artists that we will be revisiting through this Take Two format down the road? Can we give them a little tease as to what's coming up at some point later?
Absolutely. So up next for Jay-Z fans, we're going to be taking on The Black Album and Reasonable Doubt. So you definitely want to tune into that.
It is wild that in 150 plus episodes, we have never done a Jay-Z album, even though he's clearly one of the most important rap acts one of the most important rap acts, period. So this kind of fills a long overdue void. For very deeply personal reasons, one of the other people that we'll be focused on is Drake. And Drake was kind of it's been an inside joke between me and Morgan for years now. Speaking of Take Two, which was the show that was the morning show on KPCC that Morgan and I were originally paired on. And we quickly discovered in a very, you know, joking, loving manner that we were on slightly opposite sides, at least back then, on the Drake equation. And so it only made sense that we should revisit Drake for a Take Two. And again, we've never covered Drake on the show, which surprising, but this is our way of filling in that blank as well. So stay tuned for all of that.
I love you, Drake.
You've been listening to Heat Rocks with me, Oliver Wong, and Morgan Rhodes.
Our theme music is Crown Ones by Thess One of People Under the Stairs. Shout out to Thess for the hookup.
Eat Rocks is produced by myself and Morgan, alongside Christian Duenas, who also edits, engineers, and does the booking for our shows.
Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and our executive producer is Jesse Thorne.
We are part of the Maximum Fun family, taping every week live in their studios in the Westlake neighborhood of Los Angeles.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.